and tearing up of sheets, and they were trying to get through the bars and the windows. It was horrible. So we made our way out of there, and you know, left with the nurses and doctors and attendants to quiet the poor patients down again. We weren't very willing over there after that with flash powder or any kind of a camera. But I had no idea, really, when the thing we took it, what the reaction would be. Maybe later in the day we could have told them something about it ahead of time, but it was early in the morning, and they weren't ready for it, and we weren't either.
Ray, there's a photographer's story connected with the Ypsilanti torch murders.
Yes, well, mother, one of the, I think I know it's referred to, one of the men who committed the murders, was sitting in front of her home in a rocking chair on the lawn during the height of this thing. And in the sun, nice looking lady. And, you know, just so burdened with sorrow because of what her son had done. He was in jail. And I saw in the distance a photographer from another paper hiding behind trees and sort of advancing toward the house. And I couldn't, it didn't make any sense to me. But he was obviously sneaking up on this lady to take her picture. Photographers used to take the picture first and then ask, because if they asked first, answer usually was no, and then they make it difficult for the photographer to get his picture, so he just shoot. So I saw them, finally figured out what he was up to, and he jumped out from behind a tree and shot a picture of the woman and ran. And the reason I was puzzled is that I thought he knew what I knew about her. The poor woman was blind and never knew that he was in the neighborhood or he wanted a picture or had taken her picture. Didn't know anything about it, but he was stealth personified.
A problem
that was common to most of us on newspapers was financial, and it was, if anything, more of a, money was more of a problem than photographers, even than the reporters, and that's saying quite a bit. But this one fellow lived quite a ways from his office, didn't have a car, and called a cab driver over and said, "Look, don't throw your flag. I'll lie down in the tonneau of your car, and you drive me to this address, and then I have $2.75, and you you can keep the money." So the cab driver agreed, and the photographer and equipment got jammed into the tonneau of the car, and it was a horribly hot day, and a miserable ride out there. Got to his house, paid him the money, and a week later, or a few days later, rather, the photographer had come into some money, like a paycheck, and took a cab home, sat up normally in the back seat. And when he got out to his house, he found that the bill was $1.95. What he didn't know is that 2 weeks before, the cab companies had reduced their fare rates. This same fellow, to whom one night his wife was looking out the window, not wondering any longer what was detaining him. She'd given that up years before, because he was always, it seems, detained for the darndest reasons. But she saw him walking up the street a little bit unsteadily, and saw him take a bottle out of his pocket and hit himself hard over the head, and then open his collar and pull down his necktie and his coat. And he came staggering into the house screaming, "I was just robbed. I was hit over the head," and he's bleeding quietly. She had witnessed the whole thing. He didn't know it. The divorce was filed, I think, a week to the day from that last incident. Because he didn't have any money to give her. It was a different photographer, but he had acquired a frame home, a frame house for his home, for his nice little wife and family. And he was in need of painting, so he hired some painters. When he finished, he had no money to pay them, so he knew they'd be waiting for him. He got home and examined it and raised hell. He said, "This is the worst paint job I've ever seen in my life. Paint it again. Do this thing over. I'll never pay for this." So the painter said, "We'll do it again, but you're going to have to pay us double." He said, "I don't care what it costs. I want a nice looking home here, and you do it again." He thought, in the meantime, of course, he'd raise money. Well, he wasn't very successful. And the next time they finished, he came home and had the same complaint. It was the worst paint job he ever had seen. He wouldn't pay him. He'd do it again, he said, paint it right. He said, "Well, it's going to cost you three times." He said, "I don't care what it costs. Just paint this house so it'll look right and be a credit to the neighborhood. And I can hold my head high when I walk down the street." He finally did raise the money. God knows how, but he didn't pay them off. It was the most painted house in the city of Detroit. It shone for miles. And the only reason was that it took them that long to get the money to pay them for even their first color of paint, but he paid for three. One of the photographers, the night before the 500-mile race on Memorial Day, in the 30s, in Indianapolis, found himself close to a bunch of other newspapermen in his room at the hotel that had been working hard in the very hot weather for several days prior to the race, getting advanced pictures. And he went to sleep before the others had left. When he got up to hurry and get dressed in the morning to get out the racetrack, he found that his trousers were missing, and he only had the one suit. His money was gone too, but that wasn't as serious as the fact that he didn't have any pants. So he tried to borrow trousers from everyone. He couldn't get any that would fit, but some assistant manager of the hotel found him a raincoat. Now, it was about 90 degrees, and the raincoat was a heat. It was Indianapolis at its worst. And the raincoat was about three sizes too large for him. But he grabbed a cab and got out to the track, and he had his credentials to get in. He was running around the infield with the raincoat, taking pictures, and the people in the stands saw him and began hooting at him and hollering, "If there is an insane man." The police went over to throw him out, but he convinced them who he was and what his problem was, so they let him stay. But during that race, he got as much attention, everyone who was there tells me, as the cars that were involved in it. When I talked to him about it afterwards, he said, "Well, I couldn't very well stay home. I was sent to get some pictures, and I got them." He never did find his pants, but the next day he was able to buy some, because the stores, which had been closed on Memorial Day, were reopened.
This is Tuesday, August 10th, 1971, Ray's 26th anniversary. Ray, I understand our subject is blind pigs.
Oh, yes, I lived through many of them. And the period in Detroit. Now, incidentally, blind pig is, I think, somewhat of a colloquialism. It's rather peculiar to Detroit because they're called speakeasies. We're called speakeasies in most other cities, and occasionally they're referred to in Detroit as speakeasies, but I notice that I talk to people outside of Detroit about blind pigs, and they give me that strange look, because in their town. They were known as speakeasies. However, they were very plentiful. There was no trouble finding them at all. No trouble during Prohibition, or very little, to get liquor if one wanted it, or beer, or whatever. There was one that was our favorite near the Times for several years. Was operated by two men, Jimmy and Gil. And it was referred to as Jimmy King's. It was a flat, a rather large flat, on just across the street from the Times, above a store. The rooms in it were quite spacious, and the ceilings were high, and it was old-fashioned, and did accommodate a number of people. It had the usual one-way glass on the door where they could see who rang the buzzer, and either invent them or not. But it was predominantly patronized by newspaper people. And it was service, strangely, and the owners always referred to us who work on the paper as sort of one of them, whereas anyone else, and the rest of the clientele was made up of lawyers and other professional people, even cops in various grades from the police department, and robbers. It was quite a mixture of people, but everyone except the newspaper man, a regular customer, was referred to by them as an outsider, or a stranger, I should say. Stranger is a word. Now, the person could be one who went there every day, but if he wasn't working on a paper for some reason, they referred to him as a stranger. Well, I dropped in one morning, and there were no other customers there. And I was chatting with Jimmy, and he was lamenting the fact that the Iceman hadn't arrived. Now, this was before this is when ice was the principal material used to cool beer and all other drinks before the electrical appliances were refined for saloon use. He said, I don't know what's the matter with the guy, he hasn't come here yet. And just sure than anything, some stranger will come in and want a mixed drink. Well, just as he said it, the buzzer rang, and the three lawyers came in, and they all asked for whiskey sours. So he went right ahead, and if you're not familiar, whiskey sour calls for the mixing of liquor, orange juice, and ice, sugar. But ice is used in the actual shaking of the drink. So Jung went right ahead, put the ingredients, put them in the big shaker and shook, and I could hear the clicking and clinking in the shaker, and he poured out the drinks and rang up the money, came back to the other end of the bar where I was. I said, Jimmy, I said quietly, Jimmy, you told me you didn't have a bit of ice in the place. He said, I didn't. And he showed me about four dice he had in his hand. He said, I use these, those suckers won't know the difference anyway. They didn't. He always was able to make the customer happy, whether he had what he wanted or not. When eventually repeal came in, I had an idea. We knew that the liquor, wholesale liquor store in Detroit that was opening the next, on a certain morning, would have X number of brands. So I talked the office into giving me the money to buy a bottle, be the first one there, and buy a bottle of everything they had for sale, whiskey, gin, whatever else, and immediately rush it over to the city chemist, who was alerted with his assistance, and they'd analyze it. Because, you know, during Prohibition, there's a lot of bad whiskey. People were going blind and dying and having all sorts of things from this bad whiskey, and I thought maybe some of that could creep into the new batch, and we'd have had one hell of a story, and I suppose performed a public service if we'd found anything was bad. So I got the money, and I was first in line. I had a helper, and we put a bottle of everything in the cab that I had hired for the morning, and took it up at the chemist, and the chemist worked on it and graded. Well, I also had a bottle of Jimmy King's bootleg whiskey that we've been drinking for so many years. And they had that graded, too. Now, the chemist came back with grading every brand that we gave him. There wasn't anything poisonous. Some was pretty awful stuff, but it wasn't lethal. And the bootleg whiskey rated much higher than many of the brands that were legally on sale. But what the office didn't know, and I didn't bother to, I guess I forgot to tell them, was that it only takes about a dessert spoon full of whiskey to have it completely analyzed, or maybe a little less. So I had, the bottles were almost full when they got through with their experiment. And I had a whole cab full of whiskey graded, and took it to a friend's apartment. And we lined it up around the apartment according to its merit. You know, the best would be on the extreme right, and then we worked to the left. Well, the party lasted about 4 days before it was finally exhausted, called people in. But it was very reassuring. I had a story anyway, saying that there wasn't any poison whiskey being sold. And I'm sure that that reassured a lot of people, so we probably performed a public service anyway, even though it was a rather high price.
Ralph Nader would be proud of you. Public
service. Anyway, even though it was a... There were all sorts of blind pigs, as I say, around the city, very fancy with orchestra, top flight entertainers. Ted Lewis, for instance, people of that were at the height of their careers at that time. And rather expensive. The big name bands would play at some of the large ones. And they'd be very big, like the now known as the Latin Quarter, was not a blind pig. You couldn't buy anything there, but you brought your own liquor, and they sold those setups and had very first-class entertainment. They were drinking everywhere. It went from that type of luxurious setting to the apartment side, where the operator would have as a stock just maybe two or three bottles of whiskey and a half of a barrel of beer, or some bottles of beer, all of which was domestically made, that is, in an alley in Detroit someplace. It all tasted different, too. The same, it would be labeled in bottles. It'd be very hard, almost impossible to tell from the way the bottle looked whether it was real, that is, it had been brought in from Canada, because a lot of our liquor had been brought in from Canada, or whether it was just made in a, as they say, a bathtub for gin, but in a small distillery or beer or brewery. The law wasn't, of course, as you know, enforced very strictly. It was impossible to. The city would occasionally make raids, city police, but that would usually be because someone had been was complaining loudly he'd been cheated in the place or hurt. The Federals did some enforcing, and the standard fine was $1,000 for the first time. $1,000 fine or so many days in the House of Correction. Now, the bartender, if the bartender were arrested and charged, the owner would give him his option. Either the owner would pay the fine and he'd go home, or he'd take the days and the $1,000 would go to his wife. So he had, I think it was 60 days. So he had his choice of $1,000 for his wife or you know, time in jail. The river, I'll get into a little later, bringing whiskey in from Canada. Beer, some beer, but very little because it was, for obvious reasons, was too bulky, too heavy, too cumbersome to carry, and the profit was too little. Whereas whiskey, it was, brought more profit. When Prohibition first, after a few years, was in effect, the people who brought liquor across from Canada were independents. Sometimes people who lived along the river. This was in the early days of Prohibition. And would have one boat. It might be just a family affair. For instance, at the foot of Alder Road, I recall, there are some houses there, and the people had a, each family had a boat, and they used to run over, get it filled up, bring it back, and then they send it to the wholesaler, who in turn delivered to the Blind Pigs in Detroit. They didn't conduct a big business, but they made a comfortable living. But it was kind of true, they had a, see, the river was protected by, so-called protected, by Customs Border Patrol. And then on the land, they had the police or feds to worry about. But if the husband went over in the boat, the wife would give him the signal when all was clear. And the usual thing was to put a sheet, a white sheet, on the clothesline. When he saw that sheet there, he'd know that it was all right from the speed back. Of course, then he had to watch the river. This was quite, there are many catastrophes. A lot of innocent people were shot. For instance, the border patrolmen who weren't the highest, had not achieved the highest degree of intelligence or education, would chase the rum runners and shoot at them. But they wouldn't think about where the bullet would go. So persons on excursion boats, the Bottle Boat and the Tasman, which used to go up to as far as Port Huron, were wounded off. Well, not often, but several were wounded when they'd be just on an innocent trip with these wild men shooting. The bootleggers got to them too. One morning, when the morning shift of about 20 Border Patrolmen got off their boats, they were met by special agents with handcuffs for them. And they were indicted in a huge conspiracy to accept bribes from bootleggers. Then the bootleggers all got away and lived in Windsor for a while. But eventually they came back and either stood trial or pleaded guilty. And just about all of the people arrested went to prison on this conspiracy because they were just paying off. Some of them were paying off some of the crooked Border Patrolmen. And the way the government made the case was they had an undercover man, a Mr. X, It was quite mysterious for a while on this thing, and it was referred to as Mr. X working with the Border Patrol. And him, if I remember correctly, sometimes accepting bribes himself, if you want to. But that didn't slow up the importation of whiskey. And of course, more was brought over here because of the distilleries in Canada and the easy access of the river. I mean, it's a rather narrow river, and a fast boat could hop around the customs boat and get unloaded. They used to unload right downtown, and at the foot of Bates is a picture in the press club now. it was taken with a telescopic lens and run in the Detroit News of bootleggers unloading one of the boats at the foot of Bates. Bates in the river. It was an adventure. If I tried to take a boat ride on the Detroit River at night in those days, because you have to get in the line of fire. One man I knew quite well worked the river. Told me that he was loading up his boat one night with his crew, and the fellow that he didn't like, an American, came to him and said, "Do me a favor. I just bought this camel's hair coat." We used to buy camel's hair coats in Canada. They're much cheaper than they could be bought in Detroit, and they were stylish. So he said, "I just bought this coat in this box." And he said, "I can't take it through customs, so take it back on your boat." And the guy said, "All right," and he was reluctant to do it. Not because he'd be smuggling something in, because his boat was full of whiskey, and it wasn't on those grounds, but because he didn't like the guy, and it wasn't in the mood to do him a favor. However, he took it, and on that particular crossing, they were pursued by two Border Patrol boats who opened fire, and they had a hell of a time getting away from them. The chase lasted for quite a long time and went about the length of the river, and their boat was shot up pretty badly, but they landed. And the fellow, the owner of the coat, was waiting for him when they landed and brought the boat in, asking him, testing with him for taking so long. But they hand him the box with the coat in. And the coat was in the direct line of fire, and there were probably 50 bullet holes in his brand new coat. So they gave it to him. He, none of them had been hit. Some of the whiskey had been broken by bullets. Of course, many bootleggers got shot, many Border Patrolmen got shot. And they'd run, Ecorse was one of the main landing areas for liquor, and there were a lot of gambling houses. And along the riverfront, of course. Gambling was pretty wide open in Detroit in those days, too, and I don't mean just numbers for crap games, although they're very big crap games all over the city. And blackjack, any kind of game that you wanted. But down the course, they had the combination. They'd run the boat with the whiskey from Canada right into the boat well under the gambling establishment, and drop the gate, unload the boat there. So they'd have two things going for them. Some of the people got pretty big reputations nationally. St. Louis Dutch and Sleepout Louis, all were involved in those operations. The nicknames were great. There was no Nathan Detroit, contrary to the popular musical guys and dolls, but it was just about every other kind of nickname, and many persons never would use their right name or be referred to by their right name. in the interest of covering up what their activities were, what the activities of others were, they refer to that certain person, or the person this way, without even designating the sex. On the other hand, they'd be very cautious that way. And 10 minutes later, they'd be just playing big bank rolls. And I mean big, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, $20,000 maybe that they'd carry in their pockets. When they go out in the town, they were not reluctant to pull out these big rolls in other blind bags and spend money as if it was, you know, had no worth at all. And there seemed to be competition as who could spend the most among them in when they'd run into one another in some lucky local blind pig place. For instance, Dirty Eileen, favorite blind pig of the men who were in the river, and the bootleggers, and the gamblers. And it was a house on Adelaide Street between John R. and Brush. Drink of Eileen. She got the name because she swore so much. And she was really a very well-liked person whose mother, some small town she came from, thought she was in operating a beauty shop in Detroit. And at one time, the chief of detectives came to her, and he knew her well because the police used to drop in for a drink, too. And he said, "Eileen, for heaven's sake, write to your mother. She hasn't heard from you, and she's worried." And Eileen said to him, "How do you know this? You don't know my mother?" He says, "No, but I got a letter here. It's addressed to the chief of police, Detroit. My daughter, so-and-so, operates a beauty parlor in Detroit, and I haven't heard from her, and I fear that something might have happened to this innocent girl in that big, wicked city of yours," and so on. So she got in touch with her mother. But that was one of the favorite places. There were many. She had a way of doing business that was a little unusual. They'd spend their money, but she wouldn't collect when the drinks would be served. And when they'd be leaving, it's, "How much do I owe you, Eileen?" She'd say, "I don't know." You kept track. I never keep track of those things. And the result was she always got more than she would have if she'd have kept track. However, it didn't do her much good because she spent it just as fast as she got it. She, on the spur of the moment, closed her own place and went out and spent the money in some friend's saloon. And as I said, the saloons were open. The only precaution that some of them took, some of them operated just like saloons do today, except they didn't have the whiskey in the back bar, and the only precaution was they'd have on tap some near beer. And if the person came in, looked suspicious, was a stranger, they'd draw them the near beer and complain. "That's all we sell. Get out of here. This is a blind pig. There's a law against it, you know." Very indignant and cold. Some operated behind locked doors, some very secretly, but they all seemed to do well financially. I never heard of a blind pig operator going into bankruptcy. I think it was very, people went out more. The streets were completely safe, and more people lived in the city. There had not been a flight to the suburbs. And for recreation, many would spend the evenings, early morning, in a social place. Getting back to Jimmy King's, it was sort of our message center too, but Gil wasn't very skillful at answering the telephone. You see, wives were never permitted in the place. Nor was was it ever admitted on the telephone that anyone was in the place? And Gil took to answering the phone by saying, "Now, hello," but he ain't showed, and then he'd hang up. We told him that didn't quite serve our purpose, so it might have been good in one thing, but often our office would call us there, and we want to talk to them, of course. You know, in those days, you could, in the newspaper business, if something big broke, say at 2 o'clock in the morning, a man in the newspaper office could make a few, very few phone calls, blind pigs, and a couple of downtown hotels, and they have a whole staff in his office in no time at all. Now, they might be unshaven and blurry-eyed, but they'd get out an extra, and it'd be a pretty good one. Then later, of course, the whole thing changed. People started buying homes in the suburbs and rushing home to cut their lawn and do whatever else you're doing. You couldn't, you'd have to, you know, make practically long-distance calls to get them, and never be quite sure. Should you want to shut him, I'll take him. As I say, the amount of liquor that was being brought in from Canada after Prohibition went into effect was minimal, and it kept increasing as more people got in the business. At first, people were afraid of this new law. They didn't know how serious it was going to be, but more and more kept getting in the business, and it became unenforceable, of course. However, the export tax from Canada and the Detroit River and the lower part of Lake St. Clair and the upper part of Lake Erie, where the two countries are closest together, were used by anyone who wanted to use them. However, as this business got improved, and more people got in it, and it became tougher, the territories was divided up among gangs. Now, this law brought many hoodlums to Detroit from other cities, killers, robbers, gangsters, to get in on the money. And they soon had established, one group had established themselves in a certain territory on the river. Nobody else could work in there. Another group in another part, just as they cut up the city. One group would have the exclusive rights to the blind pigs in a certain section, another gang in another section. And this caused many murders, many beatings, and great lawlessness. And time went on, and the business got bigger and bigger, the crime got greater and greater, and the crime steal whiskey, not each other so much, because the hijackers were in the business of hijacking, and the bootleggers were in the business of bringing it in and distributing it or manufacturing it here and keeping from being hijacked. This, of course, was another thing that caused murders. And we had, for those years, we did have a high murder rate. It was all the gangster type thing. Nothing, however, compared with what we have today. Probably 4 or 5 times as many in the year 1971 as back in, say, 1930, which was a big year in Prohibition. Things were well established and working well.
Were the rum-running gangs organized on an ethnic basis?
Yes. Yes, almost exclusively. The Italians, Sicilians would be one. The Irish would be another. UFOs would be another. Ethnic groups, and then Jewish, the purple gang, which was all Jewish, didn't run the river very much. They had a, might have had an interest in some of the boats, but they, their big thing during Prohibition was the manufacturing of bottles, labels, beer, alley beer, and whiskey on this side of the river. They were not importers. Although they did have an interest in some, you know, they had some money invested with some others. And then just plain Americans, too, were running it. But it brought in to Detroit, several are still alive, Sicilian gangsters that made fortunes on the river and then got into gambling after that. And the Palmer, now, practically all I can think of, retired, sent their sons through good colleges and established them in big business.
Are any of the Blind Pigs around today as established restaurants or bars?
Oh, yes. Yeah. One of our best restaurants, well, two I can think of immediately. Oh, many, but two I can think of immediately. Better restaurants ran all during Prohibition, almost as if there weren't any. Schweitzer's, and they just moved upstairs from the first floor bar. And it's the fish place on Gray Trip. Joe Muir's ran during Prohibition. There must be many more that I don't think of this minute. They would, you know, it might keep the front door locked, or, they, or it might not even be locked. Or they might move upstairs, and they might continue just on the first floor. Now, that doesn't mean that just anybody could walk in and get a drink. They couldn't. They'd have to be known. But they get near beer otherwise. But they didn't have to be known too well, I mean, if they were. Yeah, many in Detroit did. They got licenses. When repeal came and continued right on in the same location. Others moved to other locations. And many of the bootleggers went into breweries, legitimate breweries. But I guess they're all out. I think they're all out of them now. Yeah, I don't think of any who have any interests that I know of now. But it was just a continuation. It was lively in Detroit then. The nights were they're outside nights, and they were made for, we thought, for fun. Maybe that was because we were young. But there are a lot of others who thought the same way, who were older. I don't know whether, I think that maybe there was a special attraction to drinking because it was against the law. But habits were funny. I went to Europe in 1929. I was riding the train from to Paris from Havre. And I had a bottle of brandy. It was some people, and we had a bottle of brandy. And I took it out and took a drink from the bottle. We were used to drinking out of bottles. Took a drink out. And I noticed it before. And then I handed it to somebody else. And they looked over their shoulder, took a drink. I remember that I looked over my shoulder. And we all, it was perfectly legal, but we all took a drink rather furtively. I suppose a lot of our drinking was that way. Another peculiarity was that people did not drink many mixed drinks. Mostly it was straight. Now you never see a person, rarely see a person drink and we ought to take liquor. No, it's a highball, or it's on the rocks, or it's a mixture of some sort. During Prohibition, we used to kid about the blind pigs. They'd say whiskey, gin, or beer. They had no time to fool around with mixed drinks. And the customer didn't seem to want to fool around either. He just gulped his drink down straight, and he'd stay around. He wouldn't leave them. But he just seemed to want to get that out of the way, I suppose. There was maybe an unconscious fear that maybe the cops would come in, he'd be arrested, although I was in many raids. When the feds would come in, or whoever, and never bother, they'd send the customers out, and just, if they took anybody, it would be the man behind the bar, and they'd take some liquor down, and whatever happened, that evidence was interesting to note. I know that later on, when I was on the pool, out of school, in the newspaper business, with restrooms, about the city used to be pretty well supplied by whom, I don't know who brought it there, but evidence, beer, gin, whatever, there was always ample to drink in a newspaper press room.
About the city being pretty well supplied by whom, I don't know who brought it there, but evidence, beer, gin, whatever, there was always